The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample. On the show this week, we consider the gut microbiome, that vast community of microbes that lives inside us. As a new public study looks at the effects of diet and lifestyle on these microbial hitches, we'll consider a new paper linking childhood obesity to antibiotics. How important are our gut microbes to human disease? Is our use of antibiotics causing metabolic problems, or is the significance of the microbiome being exaggerated, probably by people like us? Also on the show, we'll look at this week's top science stories, including the origin of the HIV pandemic, UK's new space weather forecasting centre, and the transplant that men have been waiting for, apparently. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Joining me in the studio today are Professor Nick Finer, a consultant endocrinologist from University College Hospital in London, and Nicola Davis of Observer Tech Monthly. Down the line from Barcelona, we have Tim Spector, Professor of Genetic Epidemiology at King's College London. Welcome to you all. Nick, let's start with you. You saw this paper out last week in JAMA Pediatrics, and it reported an association between childhood obesity and use of antibiotics. And just to sum over it, it found that children who had four or more courses of antibiotics by the age of two had this 10% greater risk of being obese at the age of five. What explanation do the authors give for this, and what do you make of it as an expert in obesity?
Well, the background, I guess, is we all know that there's this explosion, epidemic, as it's called, of obesity. And traditionally, we have blamed lifestyle factors, decreasing energy expenditure from exercise and activity and changes in food supply. And those are pretty good explanations, particularly on a genetic susceptibility background. But I think increasingly people are wondering, are there actually other environmental factors that could amplify the rate of increase of obesity that we're seeing? Because it is a little hard to explain just on the lifestyle factors. So one of the areas that's been of growing interest is the potential role of the microbiome, or the bacteria in your gut, on energy metabolism, energy balance. There are quite a few papers now that have found an association between the use of antibiotics in very early childhood and, for a short period of time in childhood, increased risks of becoming overweight or obese. This paper, I think, adds to that by replicating some of the findings in a very large sample from the United States. But what's also interesting is that they showed here both a dose effect. In other words, the more exposure the children had, the greater the risk. They also suggested that it was more likely if you used antibiotics that killed off a wide variety of bacteria rather than very narrow spectrum antibiotics. I think the other thing which was also interesting to put it into perspective was they looked in their sample at, if you like, confounding risk factors. Many children may be given corticosteroids for things like asthma predominantly, and they found that the risk of weight gain with steroids, which is well known, was about the same in these children as with the antibiotics. So it sort of is a good association that I think fits with knowledge we have, and as we'll probably come on to talk about, the mechanisms that have been postulated is that in some way the bacteria are altering energy metabolism. They're increasing the efficiency with which the food that we eat is used as an energy source.
I know people can't make decisions on sort of their lives from one scientific study, but looking at this, what should people take home from it? Because there will be parents out there whose children will be getting infections left, right and centre the way children do, and wondering whether antibiotic use is going to be a problem.
Well, the first thing is antibiotic use is a problem because we're seeing ever greater antibiotic resistance. And in fact, just in the news today, I saw that the man with Ebola virus in the US was first diagnosed as having a viral infection, but given antibiotics. That's by the by. But of course, antibiotics are life-saving for serious infections in children. And there is no, I think there should be no suggestion or question that where antibiotics are needed, they must be given. The risk of increasing obesity is relatively small. As far as we know, it doesn't proceed beyond 4 or 5 years. So this doesn't mean that you're permanently programmed to become obese. That's important as well. But I think it is, if you like, just another small thing which says we should be cautious about overusing antibiotics.
Is there not a possibility, given this information, that, for example, after a child's been given a course of antibiotics, they could somehow have their microbiome sort of regenerated somehow, so as for it not to be a sort of a long-term detrimental effect, or is that just not possible?
No, well, I think that is an area... Well, I'm not yet in children given antibiotics, but, I mean, there is an area of experimentation and studies going on, mainly in mice, but not exclusively so. So you can take mice that have been born and brought up in a germ-free environment, and you can do a fecal transplant, maybe not quite as bad as what we're going to hear about later, and show that if you take feces from mice which are constitutionally obese, that those previously, if you like, protected mice can become obese. There are experiments being done in humans. They're, I think, at a preliminary stage. I mean, it's not beyond the bounds of possibility, although I don't think practically we're going to do fecal transplants. I mean, what you might, though, say is that if there is a child who, say, has recurrent infections, say, pneumonia, and does require recurrent antibiotics, maybe we need to put in more vigilance, help, support to try and protect that child from becoming obese. Because at the end of the day, I think it's important we separate causes from mechanisms. The mechanisms by which people gain weight or children gain weight is too many calories for the energy that they spend. The causes, in general, we know very little about them. There are genetic causes. This is what's interesting about this study, is it's suggesting actually a cause that could link with mechanisms that we're beginning to learn about.
Let's bring Tim in. Tim, you're working on a book, The Diet Myth, about diet microbes and genetics. What do you think is happening here? What do you think these authors in particular have found?
Well, I think they're confirming an existing hypothesis that a guy called Marty Blaser started in about 2009, whereby in the US, actually, you can link antibiotic prescriptions by state with rates of obesity. And you can pretty much track the changes of obesity with use of antibiotics. And as well as this study, there was a study in Bristol that showed pretty much the same thing in Bristol kids, that antibiotics increased rates of childhood obesity. So I think there's increasing observational evidence of a real effect here. And the animal studies that have looked at the microbe have reproduced what we're doing to kids, because the average kid now has, by the age of 3, has had somewhere between 2 and 3 antibiotic courses on average, and some have had many more. And this is totally unique in our evolution, because the first 3 years of our lives are meant to develop our microbiome from zero up to a sort of adult level where we're supposed to have the perfect microbiome to help us with our immunity. If we didn't have any gut microbes, we would die. They are absolutely essential for us fighting infections, producing a third of our vitamins, the way we digest our food. So this modern epidemic, just the last 40 or 50 years of giving antibiotics routinely, thinking there's no downside to them, because in general, they are good for those rare fatal diseases, but 90% of prescriptions are unnecessary. This means that our poor old microbiome, which has been with us for millions of years, co-developing with us, is being hit by this nuclear fallout on a regular basis. The theory is that it gets so disrupted that it affects our metabolism, it affects our immune system, and this distortion in some way, which we don't understand, leads to increased obesity. And the interesting thing is that the mouse experiments which have replicated these antibiotics in very small amounts show that we do recover from antibiotics. It takes about normally 2 or 3 months. We regain most of our microbes, but sometimes the effects on the body stay, so that these mice, although they've recovered from the antibiotics, are still gaining weight.
In your view, how big a deal do you think the microbiome is in this particular issue of overweight obesity?
I think it's a major factor. I mean, as we've heard, there are obviously many causes of obesity, but I think we've got stuck in this idea that it's calories in, calories out that matters. And I think we've ignored many of the hard facts, because that doesn't add up, really, because we're not actually eating that much more than we were 40 years ago. We're not actually expending that much less energy than we were 40 years ago. But the terrain which our metabolism is working on has completely changed. So I think it's another element. I mean, I've been studying twins and genetics for many years, so I'm certainly not going to say that genes aren't important. But it's the interaction between our genes and this massively changing environment and the way we deal with our food that we've totally ignored. It's a bit like in a garden, saying that the only thing that makes a garden grow well is how much fertilizer you put into it and the product that comes out. And you're ignoring the fact that if you're using massive amounts of pesticides or changing the terrain in different ways, it's not going to alter that garden.
As you said, this is obviously something which is becoming a bigger focus, this consideration of the microbiome. But how is this going to impact on public health messages? We know how difficult it is to change public perception and to encourage particular practices, and the healthy eating movement, the increased exercise movement has really sort of been pushing quite hard in the last, decade or so to try to instill this idea in people that they need a balanced diet, they need to exercise and to combat obesity as a result of that. Is this just going to be a ticket for people to start marketing all sorts of, microbiome products and, it's going to basically erode all of that work? I mean, how do you feel about that? Is that just scaremongering?
No, I think, people are already peddling lots of microbiome products. Many of them are not effective. Many of the probiotics sold contain no actual microbial contents. So we're faced with that already. But I think if we can get across the message to people that what they put in their mouths makes a difference inside them to their own metabolism, and they can actually change their own metabolism by what they put inside them, then in a way, getting people to think more about the food they put into their stomachs, because there's a definite mechanism, a bit like feeding a garden, could have a much better effect than just saying, well, it's all about counting calories and blaming people who, for no particular fault of their own, like these kids and other people, are getting fatter because many of their microbes are disorganized and totally different to the microbes of our grandparents. And I think once you start to make this link between the food and the microbes, you can start to think of ways of altering that. Because with antibiotics, for example, 90% are given are unnecessary.
Currently, the message is, a diverse diet, lots of fruit and veg and such. Like, is this not just adding a middle component which is just going to confuse people in a way?
The messages are going to be the same, but you've got to explain why a diverse diet is good, because that will increase the diversity of your microbes.
I'm not sure that we're yet at the translational stage with this research. I mean, I think it's early research. It's fascinating. I might just add, it's not just obesity. There is some very elegant science showing how changes in bacteria can result in changes in cholesterol metabolism and can be linked with the early development of arterial disease, of atherosclerosis. There is work about how it may link to inflammation and permeability of the gut. But I think we're at a very, very early stage. And I have to say, as a clinician, I would not want to say to somebody, here's the cause of your obesity, you had antibiotics when you were a child. I wouldn't want to say, you should do this or that with your diet. I probably would roll back a little bit from Tim's point of view. I mean, I still do think that the environmental changes in terms of how much we eat, the energy density of the foods that we eat, the gradual sort of engineering of physical activity out are very important. But as I sort of suggested when I first started to discuss this, whether that's the whole story is another matter. But I don't think this is yet mature enough a field to translate into clinical care or even, I would argue, public health advice beyond the fact that unnecessary antibiotics are unnecessary.
Tim, can I just ask you to clarify how a diverse diet influences the makeup of your microbiome? Is it that the population already has the same sort of species in there, but if you have a diverse diet, then they're all being fed so their populations reach a nice sort of happy ecosystem? What's the mechanism you're talking about there?
Well, we don't know the exact mechanism. Most the work is all coming at the moment from observational studies that show that when you take obese people compared to thin people, they have a less diverse microbiome. We also know that in the West, we have on Western diets, we have a far less diverse microbiome than in hunter-gatherer groups and people who are on more traditional diets where they had a lot of different grains and fruits and berries, etc. Because the modern Western diet is actually very limited in its variety of substances. And this is probably because they're not feeding the microbes. And most of it is being absorbed. You know, our calories are going in as glucose, which comes out very early in the intestines and doesn't get to the colon where all the microbes are and need it to convert those into vitamins and energy. So the diversity thing is pretty consistent, that everyone who's ill or unwell or obese or with diabetes has a much less diverse group of microbes in terms of the functions they produce, the networks, the metabolism, and all this is generally seen as bad. And you can, certainly in mice, by altering their diets, getting them away from a high-fat, high-sugar diet to one with more fiber, for example, actually improve the diversity of your microbes and, we hope, in humans, improve health. So the health messages are actually very similar to the ones that are going out, but this time we're actually providing people with a likely mechanism that, personally, I think is a much more inspiring message that you can change things. It's not just set. It's not just about lack of free will and being fat, and that everyone is different. We know that from our studies we've looked at about 3,000 twins now, and people are incredibly different in their microbiomes. And even identical twins only share about 55% of their microbes. So all of us are very individual, which allows great room for change.
I mean, of course, one of the areas where we know we have profound effects on the microbiome, but we also use a technique for producing weight loss is with weight loss or bariatric surgery. I mean, in some ways, that's another very interesting area, because originally it was thought that these operations work by making your stomach smaller and stopping you absorbing food. And we know that that's actually a very small, probably insignificant part of how they work. And they work very impressively, not just for weight loss, but for reversing diabetes and other health issues. The sort of next era was the realization that many of the hormones secreted by the gut in response to food are involved with satiation and with improving the secretion of insulin. But we also know that these operations not only change the gut hormones, but the way that bile acids recirculate and have profound effects on gut flora. And so there's another bit of a jigsaw that is coming in here. And certainly as a physician, my hope is that, you know, in years to come, we will be able to do what the surgeons do, but without you having an operation. And whether that's giving the right mixture of gut hormones, whether it is altering your gut flora, whether it's changing the way your bile acids circulate, all of these things need to be dissected to really understand why bariatric surgery is such a powerful intervention.
It also shows that I think the bariatric surgery is a fantastic example of, you know, it's the only way we can cure diabetes at the moment. And not everyone does, but success rates are incredibly high. This is by a sudden and dramatic change in the microbiome as a paradigm of how, if we could understand what the microbes were, we could change, could be put into humans. There are possibly many other things we could have the same success with. So that's why I'm a big fan of this. I mean, I've been obsessively working on this for the last few months, and I'm not surprised that most doctors are conservative about it, because for years they didn't believe that bariatric surgery was as good as it was, because it didn't fit any of the paradigms. They couldn't understand why it would work so well. And I think once you suddenly realize that there is this whole other dimension, then this can really move the whole field forward.
I mean, I don't disagree with you. On the other hand, if you like, the counter argument is that there's been, 30 or 40 years of, you know, sort of high fiber diets, of low carb, low fat. I mean, the whole of the field of dietary manipulation has provided really very confused, I think, and mixed messages. Maybe because we don't understand what the diets really are doing, and we've thought of them in terms of macronutrients rather than effects on gut flora. But the area of nutrition weight management, I think, is a very muddied field.
Well, exactly. I think that, I mean, it's the whole whole theme of my book is how we've all been confused by everything in the last 30 years, and most people are still completely baffled by all these competing interests. But once you start to measure what's actually inside our guts and how diets alter that, then suddenly you've got a tool that you can understand why some people respond to a low-fat diet, others respond to high fiber, others respond to a low-carb diet. This is one of the things we're trying to introduce today with the British Gut Project, whereby people can do their own citizen science. They can sign up on the internet and get their own microbes sampled for as little as £60. And you can work out what your own one is and see how your microbes will change on a particular diet. Because what is absolutely true is that as we all have a different starting point, our microbes are very different and our responses to different diets are completely different.
Tim, Nick, it seems that a week doesn't go by without there being a decent microbiome story coming our way in the media. And in Nature last month, there was a piece from Bill Hannage at Harvard Public Health talking about almost a warning that we might be getting carried away with microbiome research, that it may be suffering from hype. And I was keen to get your views on that, whether you think everyone is now trying to sort of jump on a microbiome wagon and whether that's actually obscuring good work, or whether, you know, we need to be just very cautious about some of this stuff, that it's easy to get very excited by some mouse studies that may not translate and all the rest of it. What do you think? How seriously should we take all this?
I would say this is a new area of research and medicine, and we therefore quite rightly, I think, need to establish new rules by which we assess the validity of studies. One of the issues in this area is the informatics required to really analyse the data of the microbiome genome. I mean, it's like doing astrophysics if you're going to really look at, you know, to a very deep level. The second thing is, you know, separating cause from an effect, reverse causality, where something changes because of something else rather than causing the change. And these are some of the issues that were raised in this paper. So I think it is appropriate that we, if you like, agree, a bit like Koch's postulates that, you know, sort of however many hundred years ago were required to prove that a particular bacteria caused an infection, there were these rules to establish it. And I think that's what's going on at the moment, is that there is discussion about what the rules are to accept the findings that are being made.
Yeah, well, I think every new area comes with this cycle in science that you get a lot of papers published, a lot of hype. The big journals want more of those papers, and some of them get through that wouldn't get through a year later with extra rigor. And then you get a reaction from people, sometimes outside the field, sometimes inside it, reacting against it, saying, oh, this is, you know, all the money and attention is going on this field. So it's a natural cycle, whether it's genetics, epigenetics, microbiome, protein research, whatever. And we are still finding our way, and the studies are getting better every year. They're getting more rigorous. And I think we have to move from the study which just compares humans by association, saying this group of people have more of this bug than these ones, which is just rather low-level association, to the next level, which is taking those microbes from one group and then putting them into mouse models to see what they actually do. And I think this is the most exciting part of the area, is that rather than using mice to tell us what's going on in humans, I think there are some lovely studies now, and we've got a paper coming out in a few weeks showing this, where you take twins where one is obese and one is lean. That's just an association. You can see there are different microbes there. But if you take their microbes and you put those implanted into mice and show them getting fatter, then that's a clear sign of causality. The more we can do these rigorous studies, the more we advance the field. But there are a few dud studies out there, but for the most part, it's all moving in the right direction, and I'm confident that we'll get higher standards of rigor and the field will continue to improve.
Nick, Tim, thanks so much for sharing your thoughts on this. We'll no doubt be covering all the microbiome research that comes up over the subsequent years, and that'll all be at theguardian.com/science.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
An international team of scientists led by Oxford University and the University of Leuven has reconstructed the genetic history of the HIV pandemic, the event that saw HIV spread across the African continent and around the world. They've concluded that it kicked off in Kinshasa, capital of the Democratic Republic of Congo, around 1920. The team's analysis suggests that between the 1920s and 1950s, a perfect storm of factors combined to see HIV move out from Kinshasa and spread rapidly across the globe. They included urban growth, changes to sex trade, and strong railway links during Belgian colonial rule that made Kinshasa one of the best connected of all Central African cities. The Congo River also played its part. How did they do this?
So what this group did was they took a lot of genetic samples, a lot of DNA from HIV taken from the 1950s through to around the 1980s to more modern times. A lot of these samples were identified retrospectively because back in the 1950s in Central Africa, you wouldn't have known that you had an HIV case very easily because the symptoms were all over the place. People had poor immune systems, and so you know it wouldn't really go down on their record. It wasn't an identified disease. But there is now a decent record of DNA samples of the pandemic subtype, which is HIV1M. What was interesting about it is, although HIV didn't go into humans from chimpanzees in what is now the Democratic Republic of Congo, that probably happened in southern Cameroon sometime earlier. The virus probably jumped a number of times with other subtypes jumping into humans just from bushmeat from hunting these animals. But for some reason, the pandemic strain became what it became, infecting something like 75 million people. What this group did was, after piecing together getting all the DNA together, they produced a family tree through which they could track back the sort of the emergence of the virus back through time and space to different places. And they checked it all with historical records and tried to piece together a plausible scenario rather than anything they can be absolutely sure of. As the researchers said to me, you'd really need a sort of time machine to go back and be sure of any of this. But what they say is that around 1920s, the virus got into Kinshasa, where at the time it was the largest city in the region. It was growing very rapidly. Under Belgian colonial rule, you had very good railway networks down to a mining region in the south. This railway line went about 1,500 kilometers in its entirety through a mining region where there was a lot of immigrant workers. That transport link pulled a lot of the virus, took a lot of the virus on people down towards that area where it established itself as another reservoir. The Congo River, moving north and east up to Kisangani, did the same thing. They refer to it as a perfect storm of events. They also talk about how there was a very high proportion of males in the area driving a lot of sex work. At the time, doctors may have been using unsterilized needles. A lot of these factors seem to come together to really drive that virus out from Kinshasa between the 1920s and 1960s, when it really seems to then go wallop into the rest of Africa, crossing borders and crossing continents. And it's just, I think, an interesting study that pulls together a lot of documentation, a lot of historical records, and uses the genetics to track back, to work out what a plausible scenario may have been. But I was interested in asking you, Nick, actually, do you see the creation of a backstory like that, if you like, for you know, an enormously devastating pandemic, to be of any real value other than its history? I don't know if these things have sort of clinical value. I mean, these things could probably be presumed that these things would spread that disease around.
Well, I mean, I suppose it does, you know, raise questions of, are there things in the future that are going to occur that we can prevent now? I mean, I think it is interesting. I mean, I do remember very well a long time ago having a patient who died from an overwhelming pneumonia. It was very bizarre, very odd. She was a young, otherwise fit person. And it was probably 5 years later that Legionnaire's disease was first identified. And I'm guessing, but almost certainly that's what she had. So sometimes these stories actually help to make sure that we keep our minds open when we see newly presenting things. The thought that occurred to me that was quite interesting is, of course, that communications, the bicycle transport, has also been a great force for good in ensuring genetic diversity and preventing inbreeding. And here seems to be a story which is saying, actually, it can be the reverse.
Tim, do you think these kinds of studies are give us more than sort of plausible stories? Do you think they bring us anything that's particularly valuable for public health?
I think so. I think it's a detective story, because most people who worked in this field, I remember being in the early 80s working in Belgium, and these early cases came in from the Belgian Congo, and everyone just thought this was some very recent outbreak at the time, that there was no, it wasn't like something had been brewing for 30 or 40 years. The idea that when you see something new, this could be, part of some longer epidemic, and you need to cast the net wider with new, and new technology can help you do that, I think it is of great interest, because it just means that we shouldn't always think of every new disease as part of a continuum of something else. I think it does make us think and realize that if we start saving samples, some new technology will come along which will help us unravel it.
It seems the UK has got some exciting plans afoot for forecasting the weather in space. Ian, you've been looking into this.
Yeah, so I was speaking to some space weather forecasters down at the Met Office in Exeter earlier in the week, and on Wednesday they'll be launching the UK's public space weather forecast system. So they already have a system that goes out to interested companies, people who have a commercial interest in knowing what space weather is coming. And so this is things like the solar wind, the particles that stream out of the sun that can cause the aurora, but it can also cause problems to spacecraft, can degrade electronics. And if you can predict the strength of the solar wind, if you know how intense the stream of particles coming to Earth can be, it's very useful for those companies to have in sort of backup systems ready and so on. And even airlines can start redirecting flights so they avoid the poles where most of the radiation will be, and astronauts will stay inside the space station instead of going out and so on. So what they're looking at is trying to get information from ground-based systems and also loads of satellites, and using US satellites as well, to try and get a picture of what is happening with the sun, what is going to come our way that might cause problems. And it's always for electronics. I mean, it's either high energy particles coming in on the solar wind, or these things called coronal mass ejections from the sun, which are these enormous fast moving clouds of plasma which fire out and have their own magnetic fields. And when they interact with the Earth's magnetic field, when they arrive, and it can take some time to get here, a couple of days sometimes, you can get, if the orientation of the plasma's magnetic field is a certain way, you can get geomagnetic storms on Earth, and those things can induce currents in electrical grids. In 1989, in Quebec City, there was the famous incident where one of these geomagnetic storms knocked out an electricity grid that supplied 6 million people. So the UK is getting on board with this, and they're even practicing the classic kind of weather forecaster forecast, where they have someone in front of a green screen with the sun behind them, trying to take people through, this is what's happening on the sun, and this is what you can expect in space weather. But they admit they have a barrier to get over with public understanding of what some of these terms mean and what the implications are.
There are already some satellites out there which are looking at space weather, I believe. But the part of the problem is, even if they detect something large coming our way, it only gives us, 30 minutes to do something about it? It's not very long. How is this going to change that?
It depends what it is, because the streams of particles, the solar wind, that can be getting here immensely quickly. You'd be talking about minutes, as you say. But with some of the coronal mass ejections, you can have a few days' notice that something is on its way. And a lot of the companies that can be affected will have systems that they can bring in to try and get around it. They do have backup systems for electrical supplies. They can start redirecting flights and so on. So that information, say at the moment, is going to those kind of private commercial companies. But the idea of making it public and it being a regular thing on their website, which I think is going to be really interesting and educational for people, might actually be, it might be more interesting than the normal weather forecast. Because I think normally a more accurate weather forecast than anything is to really look out the window and say, chances are it'll be like this. But they say at the moment, they're probably about 20 years behind normal weather forecasting in terms of their accuracy. So there are going to be a few summer barbecue moments, I imagine, when they give false alarms. But we'll see what happens.
I can see broadband companies now having a new excuse for when your connection goes down.
Yeah, I think that's what's going to happen. And there's plenty more on this at theguardian.com/science. Nicola, you've been looking at some laboratory work that's probably going to make our male listeners prick up their ears.
Well, this was a story that was in the Observer's Discover section on Sunday. And it's basically about a new kind of organ transplant that's being pioneered in North Carolina. And in fact, it's penis transplant, which everyone, you know, I can see you all twitching with wanting to smile, but it's a very important organ for 50% of the population, and indeed the other 50%, you could argue as well. So this isn't a trivial organ to be looking at all. It's something which has captured the interest of a researcher called Anthony Atala. It's not the first organ that he's been looking to create in the lab, as it were. He created in 1999 a bladder that could be transplanted. He's created vaginas, and he's looking forward to creating kidneys, livers, hearts, lungs. But at the moment, he's focusing on the penis.
People have tried these transplants before, and I know of at least one case I wrote about that didn't go terribly well, in that the chap had it removed sometime later because he couldn't get on with it. Presumably, you need to do enormous psychological profiling before you put someone through this.
I think the case you're talking about was the 2006 case, and that was basically just a direct transplant. What they're doing now is actually using cells from the man himself on a sort of collagen framework from a donor penis, and then kind of growing the penis with his own cells. So it's not like it's just somebody else's that's been sort of appended. It's actually sort of grown for them.
But you're taking a donor, let's call it organ, stripping the cells off it, keeping the collagen scaffold, repopulating it with the man's own cells, so you don't get immune rejection.
Yes,
when are they going to do this?
Well, they've already managed to do it in rabbits, which arguably you could say rabbits don't need a lot of help in this area.
There's one way to test it, I suppose.
But and the rabbits actually, they managed to get rabbits to mate this way. They found that they could ejaculate, and they found that they could produce offspring using these new organs. So, you know, there's definitely hope there for people who require this kind of transplant.
Tim, I have to ask your thoughts on this.
I'm speechless, really. I'm just trying to think of, it must be a bit depressing if you've got this thing and it's taking 5 years to grow. That would be a bit of a turn-off, I think, for many people.
Can you take me through, Nicola, how a man ends up in the unfortunate situation of requiring one of these operations?
All sorts of reasons. You could be born with some sort of genital defect. You could have had some sort of injury or accident. I mean, these things do happen. You could have had some sort of cancer, which might have led to moving part of your penis. But there are all sorts of reasons why somebody might require this. But the other thing is that then looking not just at replacing the whole organ, but also parts of it. And this is sort of in the more sort of near future where this might be rolled out. So they could actually replace just parts of the penis. So, for example, that could help with curing erectile dysfunction.
That's all we have time for this week. A huge thanks to Tim Spector and Nick Finer for helping us with this week's stories. From me, Ian Sample, and all the science team, thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simple yet powerful website building platform. As a Guardian podcast listener, it goes without saying that you're a clever clogs. The good news is that building your own professional website with Squarespace is easy. Whether the site you need is for a small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog, getting started takes seconds. Go to squarespace.com today and show support for this podcast and get 10% off. Use the offer code GUARDIAN.